Good morning, and thank you, Carolyn. You have no idea what kind of pressure a guy is under to be following a public speaking expert. I have nothing to disclose, and I'm literally demonstrating that here. I'm a former newsman, so by shedding a layer, we can maybe get down to business here and be more comfortable. I work for the CDC, and this is a second career for me. I started out in health journalism, general journalism in electronic television and radio back in Madison and Milwaukee, Wisconsin in the 70s. And went to CNN in 1981, where I was medical correspondent from 1981 to about 2000. So I believe in the power of television as a public health communication vehicle, and was able, after leaving CNN, to go back and get some advanced degree work done, an MPH at Emory University, and then take that to the CDC, where I am today. I work presently in global health communication. Soon, the new developing Center for Global Health at CDC is where we'll be housed shortly. Done a lot with the State Department. What we're going to talk about this morning is how interrelating with the media abroad has, we think, helped improve the quality of journalism covering influenza. This talk was proposed way back in February, and that was before we had H1N1 influenza to worry about. So the focus in your program is on bird flu, and there's still a lot of that in there. But I also brought in some other H1N1 topics here that I think are relevant to our present focus. In a nutshell, I think it's important for us as communicators, especially in an agency like mine, to keep in mind that we only can be as good as the cargo on the truck here. So if you look at my analogy for a second, the formal communication strategy is what we're doing to get relevant information that's good stuff, good merchandise, to the right people through the right channels. And we don't want to drive an empty truck, and we don't want to drive it to the wrong place. But I am not a physician. That's one reason, by the way, that I left CNN. They wanted a physician in that job finally after all those years. And in Sanjay, they have one. So that's a good move for them. He's a good guy. But seriously, it's important for us not to get ahead of our own technical experts. By the same token, this doesn't do much good sitting in the loading dock or sitting in the warehouse. It's got to get to where people need it. And channels are an important conduit for getting that communication across. So what have I done for State in the last few years? Well, and the Voice of America have also been sponsoring this. We've been to a dozen countries, put on about 30 workshops involving over 500 journalists by now, and 1,000 newsmakers. I'm talking to both sides here. It's not just the journalists. It's important that the people who relate to them also do so effectively. And that's awfully hard for a lot of people, even here, but especially in developing countries, I think, where there tends to be a lot of animosity between the press and government or any symbols of authority. It's a problem. And sometimes it's very publicly displayed. Now, there's distrust of press here as well, and sometimes for good reason, but by and large, one of the things that makes us uncomfortable with the press, I think, is when we hear our words played back to us. And it's very easy to say, well, I've been taken out of context. Did I really say that? Probably you did. And probably the reporter successfully honed in on the essence of your statement. But yeah, sometimes having it played back to us is a little discomforting. It's sort of like standing there and looking at a mirror, you know? It's just not as good as you'd like it to be, you know, in many cases. So why do we want to use the media? Well, because people do use the media too. And they read, even in India, 65% literacy rate there. You'd think it might be lower than that, but a lot of people can read. And even if they can't afford a newspaper, look at, they can go and look at one publicly posted. So the media is widely used just about everywhere you go. And while we in the United States are going through kind of a media revolution now with the emergence of social media, the electronic digital means, in developing countries that's happening too, but at a much slower pace. So the traditional press, the newspaper is healthier there. The quality of journalism isn't necessarily better, frankly, it's usually not, but a lot of people are reading a lot of papers. Radio is a big deal in many developing countries, and television as well. We in public health should keep in mind, by the way, that it's not just the telling that's important. We have a message to tell, of course, But if we're going to be good at our strategy, remember the fuel in the truck, driving it to the right place, we got to be good listeners too. And there are more journalists than there are of us. So they can be our eyes and ears in helping to set the agenda for communication message refinement, especially in an acute public health emergency like influenza might turn out to be. Now, there's going to be a little back and forth here. This is a little bird flu stuff. Bird flu range is primarily a disease of animals, remember. Very few cases in humans, thank goodness, because it's bad news when we do get it. But you can see that it is primarily confined to the continent of Asia and made it as far west as Europe and down into Africa as well. Not sure how it got to Nigeria. No one has found a wild bird that carried bird flu down there. But it has shown up in poultry, so possibly through exports. How in the world have we been spared this long? No one really can say for sure. There's two ways we could get bird flu in the Western Hemisphere. One would be migratory waterfowl, since they are the carriers and natures of these virus. And the other would be through either intentional or accidental introduction through shipments of birds. So far, and we're looking very, very carefully for this, haven't seen any, and we've been out at it for a couple of years. Poultry is a big deal. It is a public health issue. It's also an economic one, but I think the two overlap significantly. Poultry and the public health are intertwined. You can see every country you go to, just about, poultry is important. And when they die, it's an economic tragedy and it's also a loss of protein for people. And people get very frightened when they see images like this on television. Here's what happened in India. 9 poultry farmers in India killed themselves and face a grim future. Not a single bird flu human fatality in India after a number of years of outbreaks across that country, primarily in West Bengal, but elsewhere as well. No one has died of the disease, but we have had some people that have, out of despair, taken their lives because of it. So that's an important problem. The economic ramifications are severe. There is a roller coaster effect. First, the prices plunge. Nobody wants to buy anything anymore. And then they soar. Why? Because industry quickly gets responds to the slack demand, and there's no fertile eggs, there's not enough day-old chicks, and so when farmers finally do want to get back in the business, the prices of those commodities are higher. They're reflected at the marketplace, and people then become frustrated because they can no longer afford the chicken and the eggs once they're confident that they're safe to eat again. By the way, at one workshop in Bangladesh this spring, this came up. We had a poultry industry leader talking to a room full of journalists, and the journalists were very hostile towards this guy because they blamed him for purposely gouging them on price. So they weren't acting as journalists in that moment. They were acting as consumers who were frustrated and upset that the market was being, they thought, manipulated by the industry. This guy very patiently explained to them that they needed to learn a little bit about the law of supply and demand, that he too wished that prices were stable, but had nothing to do with the fact that they weren't. So it's not just that journalists might not know enough about influenza, they may not know about the laws of supply and demand either. They may react as consumers rather than professionals, and they forget the power of their words. So when this frustration turns into copy in a newspaper or a broadcast, that's a problem, and it's one of the things that as a former journalist and now as a public health guy, I can kind of bridge that gap, hopefully. There really needs to be more people who can do this kind of training so that journalists are reminded, for one thing, that their responsibility is profound. Their words are very powerful. Journalists are used to being criticized for their work. They are seldom praised and seldom are they reminded how important their role in society really is. That's one of the things we've been trying to do through these workshops too. Not just to blow hot air at them, but to really impress upon them that they do have a higher calling, especially if they're dealing in health journalism, where people do take things very personally. So one of the other things that we want to do in this is to set reasonable expectations. In Nepal this year, journalists were criticizing the government for not keeping H1N1 out of the country, despite airport screening, which they had at that time. Doesn't work, by the way, for very long. Maybe at the very beginning. But this is an example of unreasonable expectations. Easy as it is to blame the government when things go wrong. Our job is to set reasonable expectations. We wish we could flatten this curve and not have any problem by having good planning and good response to influenza. Nobody gets sick, nobody dies. We know that is not possible. We know that influenza, for one thing, it spreads in the asymptomatic phase. So watching people get off an airplane, and by the way, if they've just been on it for 12 hours, everybody looks like crap, right? I mean, you're not going to look too good coming off an airplane, right? And you say, well, you're sick, you're not. It's not that easy. And even if you look wonderful, you may be shedding virus at that moment. So eventually, this disease is going to catch up with our efforts to contain it. So we got to set reasonable expectations, which are that we can maybe flatten that curve a little bit. Maybe have less severe instances of disease by doing these things, using antiviral treatment if we have it, although frankly, I think we've kind of oversold that too in our communication. Isolating sick patients, that's done every day in hospitals, quarantining for those that are exposed. That word is a kind of a red flag. We're going to have to define it for folks. Social distancing, which simply says, keep the kid home if they're sick today. Don't go to work yourself if you're not. Vaccine if you're available, supportive care, and recognize a true emergency. This is something that our flu plans really have needed to do because of the importance of the possibility of hospitals being swamped with cases. And this happened in Argentina and Peru this summer where, you know, their seasons are opposite of ours. So their flu season included H1N1 for the first time on top of their seasonal flu. And they had a rush on hospitals with people who weren't that sick. That will happen. It could happen here, too. Up to us, then. It's up to us in our communication to provide good instruction on what constitutes a true emergency. When do you need to get to the front of the line? And when can you treat the situation successfully at home? The baby's having a hard time breathing, if your lips are blue, chest pains, that is a true emergency. Things like that, and our messages are including that as well. I'm not going to spend much time on this except to show you that in the A strains of flu, and those are the kinds that cause pandemics, the natural reservoir for these is waterfowl. H and N refer to proteins on the surface of the virus that mix and match in various ways to cause new strains. Flu virus is always changing a little bit at a time because when it reproduces in the cells of the host, it's a bad speller and it makes genetic errors and copies itself. Once in a while, it makes a profound shift in the genome, and then you have a strain to which people have limited or no immunity. That's what defines a pandemic. And that's what we got now. And here, these are old data, actually. Excuse me, this is bird flu cases. These are as recent as they come. And the point here is that over a period of many years, only 400 cases worldwide. Considering that these outbreaks have occurred in the most densely populated places on Earth, like, you know, Java Island in Indonesia, across Vietnam and China and places like that, a lot of people living close to the land in those areas. Fortunately, well, it's tragic for those 400 people, of course, especially when you look at this mortality rate. But it could be a lot worse if this disease were easily transmissible from person to person, and it is not. The virus has not changed in ways that make it so. Most of these cases, probably 400 of the 442, maybe more than that, were from exposure to sick animals rather than human-to-human transmission. Compare that now with the H1N1, which is a pandemic. The other one is an epizootic. That is a disease of animals that occasionally crosses the species barriers into people. H1N1, the pandemic strain, does actually have a very low mortality rate, thank goodness, but a very high attack rate. And these numbers are quite inaccurate because no one's counting cases anymore. We have millions of cases in the United States alone at this point, and it's really a waste of our effort to try to count those. You can't. Most of the influenza specimens that are being tested in North America right now are positive, H1N1 positive. Some people are going to die from this disease because flu is a dangerous disease, and the more they get sick, the more folks are going to die. But the case mortality rate remains more or less like seasonal influenza. Still a serious matter, still tragic, but fortunately not nearly as lethal as H5N1. But you can see the difference here. On the one hand, you have a very dangerous virus that rarely affects people, but when it does, it's very dangerous. On the other hand, we have a pandemic strain, which by definition, most of us are susceptible to that, and therefore at great risk of incurring that infection. We're going to feel crummy for a week or two, most of us, and we're going to get over it. Some of us won't, though, and that's why we have to find high-risk groups that really need to get to the front of the line as the vaccine becomes available. Back to bird flu. What do we talk to the reporters about? Generally, it's livestock management. Americans would not need to have an audience or a message like this. Too many of them wouldn't anyhow. But the big deal in Asia is to try to isolate domestic from wild birds. We call that biosecurity. To recognize disease and to report it when it happens. They don't like to do that because nobody wants someone to come on their farm and start killing all the birds. You know, I mean, you would say, well, they're going to die anyway, and frankly, they probably will, but some guys, excuse me, guys, try to sneak these birds somewhere before they die or just dump them or eat them themselves. If you have nothing else to eat, can you blame them? What would you do? I mean, you know, this is where harm reduction comes in, and you can encourage people to be extremely careful about how they handle that meat. If you cook chicken meat, by the way, you kill the virus. So if there's anything in those tissues, it spawns the meat through the cook. Most cultures, that's okay. It's a problem in some where there is, as a delicacy, raw or undercooked poultry or the blood of it or something like that. So that's a problem in those areas. By and large, though, people are getting the message that you have to cook it thoroughly. By the way, one other point. The chickens die. The ducks don't. Typically, the ducks will become carriers and will be asymptomatic or they'll have very mild illness. So people can have this in their duck flocks and not realize it. And one of the things Asian people tend to do is they're raising rice and they're raising these birds. Well, they harvest the rice and there's a lot of rice left over, send the birds out there to peck at it, and the wild birds come in too. So that's where you have a lot of intermingling. We don't do too much of that in Georgia, so that's not a problem here. What else can we say? Keep the kids away from livestock. Again, this is kind of hard to sell because the chore habit is the kids do that kind of work. But these are the kinds of things that we want journalists to be including in their stories. What do we want them to include with respect to H1N1? I hope you've seen some of this in our press. We're almost getting teased now about hand washing because we really don't have a whole lot more to offer at this point. And it actually does some good. It is helpful. There are some data that suggests that hand washing is a good way not only to prevent influenza, but maybe the common cold. People are always, no one in this room is doing it. You guys are really very well disciplined. There's almost always somebody, but no one today. I wouldn't out you if I saw you. But anyhow, you know the drill. And these are things that we would like to get in the media. And again, what those two warning signs, if there is a need for someone to seek medical care, what does it take for them to need to be getting to the line, in front of the line? Now, a couple minutes left. I want to talk about some lessons learned that we have had in dealing with pandemic influenza communication. By the way, I have one disclaimer at the beginning that I don't take money from anybody. I do work for the federal government, though, but I am not speaking for them today. Okay? I'm a CDC guy, but you're hearing my opinions. The government may or may not agree with me on this. I hope they do. They might not. We have done a good job of strengthening global surveillance around flu. That's one thing that SARS really taught us. Surveillance has gotten much, much better. Specimen sharing is so important. Remember again, flu virus, bad speller. It's always mutating a little bit. We need to stay on top of that, not only for the major changes in the genome, but for the minor ones as well. And when the first H1N1 specimens showed up in California and Texas, those states, their excellent sentinel surveillance systems, picked up a strain. They didn't know what it was. They knew it was a flu. They knew it was an A strain virus. Didn't know what kind. Their tests wouldn't determine that. They got it to Atlanta, and we were able to subtype that quickly as a new and novel virus. That was good news, and internationally that news was spread. The international health regulations make us do that, but we would have done it anyway. Those of you should be aware of that if you're interested in global health, that as of 2005, the new international health regulations are in effect, and we in the United States are working very actively to improve capacity for countries everywhere to follow them. That the government would agree with for sure. Develop detailed response plans that we have done over the last couple of years, and again, the IHR, as I just mentioned. On the other hand, our plans focused on the big one. People thought the pandemic would automatically involve a lot of mortality, and so far, this one doesn't. Thank goodness, nobody wants a bad pandemic, but it still is confusing to get that right. Everyone also assumed it would start in Asia, and here it is, it started in North America, and this one really makes me not only sad, but kind of angry that we named this novel virus in haste, and that has caused problems. Some positives. Communicating uncertainty. This is a quote from CDC News Conference. The early stages of an outbreak, there's much uncertainty, probably more than anyone would like. Our guidelines and advice are likely to be interim and fluid. We're setting people up for change. And when we talk to the press, that's important as well. Getting the word out, the way we protect ourselves from a new virus is the way we protect ourselves from seasonal flu. Washing our hands, staying home when we're sick, those are the messages that continue to be reinforced. Hopefully they're resonating not only with folks who might get sick, but with their employers as well. And the genuine concern. Good risk communication includes empathy, and the best spokespeople should be able to convey that naturally. You cannot fake it. Sadly, 28 pregnant women in the U.S. have died so far from H1N1 influenza. Dr. Ann Schuchat, I think, made the statement. She's very, very good at this. She's in charge of the CDC Center dealing with influenza. Now some negatives. This was a part about, see this? Swine influenza in California. This was right at the very, very beginning we did that. And what a shame. Once that genie is out of the bottle, you can't put it back in. And there have been some stigmatizations as a result of that statement. And then reinforcing it. Then we said, well, we're now going to call it H1N1. You added a bunch of letters. Nobody remembers those either. So that's not a good handle for it. Finally, WHO refers to it as pandemic 2009 H1N1. Another mile-long title. The point is, we don't, you know, swine, if I was a reporter still, I'd call it swine flu. But it caused an unnecessary culling of swine in Egypt, people that made their living, a minority sect that the government or others had it in for. Anyhow, this became an excuse to get rid of all the pigs in Cairo. And now they have a huge problem with organic waste management in Cairo. It's also, by the way, depressed pork prices in the United States too, and so unnecessary. Yeah, there's swine genes in the virus. There's also bird genes in it, but it is a pandemic strain. This is a human virus at this point. It would be all right to mention those other points in context, but it wasn't. It came out as swine flu, and oh, that's cool, we're going to call it swine flu, and so we did. And you cannot get it from eating pork. Although, wait, by the way, there you, but pork can get it from us. Flu goes back and forth all the time between people and pigs. And I just saw on the news ticker thing on the outside this hotel this morning that there is apparently a big herd of swine, and I didn't see the details of the story. Anyone did? Did you see it? Oh, you saw it too. Evidently, there is an outbreak of swine flu in swine. Don't worry about the pigs. They're going to be fine. They're going to have a snotty nose like everybody else and feel cranky for a few days, but they'll get over it. They'll be fine. Selective negatives, were we overly optimistic? Yeah, I think so, by promising vaccine too early. Although, when I looked at the transcripts of our news conferences, our guys were pretty careful, but it just goes to show you can't be careful enough. Because when you say there's going to be vaccine available in October, that means I'm going to get my shot in October. And I'm not pregnant, and I'm not, you know, in a high-risk group, so I'm not going to, you know, be getting that. And yet, maybe I want it bad enough to raise Cain about it. What should we do? Let's acknowledge that the media are an excellent vehicle to get to the public quickly. Their job isn't ours, though. Let's look for that overlap. They want good sources. They want to be relevant. We want them to be, so let's be there for them, but let's also understand they're going to be critical of us, and they may emphasize things that we don't think they should be emphasizing. As long as they're getting the story accurately, though, we shouldn't worry so much about that. But let's work with them, let's get to know them, and you do that by dealing with them patiently and not being scared to death of them. They're not usually that bad. If we want to be available, we want to be the first with bad news to err on the alarming side, be human, be simple. Simplify, but be honest. You know, you can see this might get worse before it gets better. There's a lot we don't know about this thing yet. Those are good messages to put out there. They enhance rather than lower our credibility. Seems a little bit counterintuitive, but it's so. Respecting people's fears and concerns. I am, got to stop here, but Thailand didn't do that. They scolded people for not eating chicken, and starting by denying, and finally they admitted that there was a problem a few days later, but in the course of that time, they lost all their credibility by scolding people and saying, why won't you eat chicken? You're hurting your country. They wouldn't eat chicken because, you know what, dead chicken's not very appetizing on TV, and I'm going to have something else instead. If they had worked through that and say, I can see why you might not want to eat chicken, they would have gotten over it faster. That's another lesson in miscommunication. Last one, I'm going through these real quick, but I just want to show you why once in a while we need this. They tell us when we need to do more. This newspaper in New Orleans became the voice of the nation, of that community, at a time when they were literally brought to their knees by tragedy. Similarly, it helps us heal. The media can help us get over things. In China, where they had a devastating earthquake, in the city of Chengdu, that woman expressed the sentiments, I think, of that area. I love my city, I love you, all because of you, Chengdu will be better. It was a way of galvanizing the support of the nation around a tragedy. And the media does that very well for us, too. And I hope that you keep that in mind. Thank you.